Good afternoon. Thanks for spending lunch here. The advantage is you don't have to wait in line afterwards to get lunch. My name is Chad Priest. I am the CEO of the MASH Coalition. We're a nonprofit in Indianapolis. I'm also an adjunct assistant professor at the School of Nursing, and I'm on the fellowship faculty at the School of Medicine at Indiana University. So I have like 8 jobs. I'm here today to talk about a community-based participatory research program we established that deals with ways to build resilience among providers of services for sexual assault and domestic violence. And it was an interesting project, and I got a lot of slides I'm probably not going to talk about, but I wanted to make sure we had them, you know, on the computer thing. But I'll tell you at the outset that my initial experience in domestic violence work was in the military, where I worked with family advocacy programs in the Air Force as a nurse. And so, but I'm hardly an expert in domestic violence or sexual assault. And so while I did that work for many years, I've been out of it for a very long time. But that's why this thing even happened in the first place. Like all things that have happened well in my life, it was my wife that prompted us to take on this project, and I'm glad she did. So I'm just going to remind you quickly that emergencies keep happening more often than we expect. We have a warming climate. We have a bad economy. We have all sorts of things that are leading to infrastructure challenges. And our ability to respond to emergencies is worse than it was 10 years ago, perhaps not better. And I say that being someone who's in the business. So that's it's not really a critique. It's more of just an observation. Part of the reason is that we have spent about $15 billion since 2001 in healthcare emergency management, primarily focused on making sure that hospitals have enough stuff so that when something bad happens, they can help everyone. What we know is that that doesn't actually work. There's no evidence there's no evidence, by the way, it doesn't work. There's just no evidence either way. So what we have is what we call SOS, which is a lot of stuff on shelves, except we don't say stuff. And what's needed is a way of thinking about how communities as a whole use the healthcare system in crisis, and what we call the phrase in the industry is the management of medical surge, right? Which is making sure that patients don't overwhelm hospital facilities. Our organization is a healthcare coalition. Sorry, I've got a lot of these doomsday slides, so I hate to let them go by. I mentioned that already. Our coalition is the largest healthcare emergency management coalition in the United States, and our mission is to make sure that healthcare providers can respond effectively to emergencies and remain viable through recovery. So why are we in here talking to the Violence Caucus at the American Public Health Association? Well, a couple of reasons. One of the I'm going to just keep going through here because I got way too many slides. We are a public-private partnership. So at the outset, our entire organization is strange in that we are owned by the private sector and the government. So our employees are private sector employees, but we perform in some aspects quasi-governmental functions around emergency management, particularly in liaisoning during crisis between the private sector healthcare system and the public sector response system. The way we do that is to play offense on surge. So there are two ways to keep hospitals from being overwhelmed in emergencies. One way is to train all the hospitals to expand quickly and take on more people. The other way is to keep the hospitals from being burdened in the first place. The first approach is what we do most of the time. The latter approach is really hard because it requires public health, and public health is hard work. And so we have, of course, chose the hard route with mixed success. I will tell you about a project that we do. I'm going to fast forward through these to get to the main meat here. Okay. We build projects to manage surge by a very scientific process that is loosely based on community-based participatory research. So for those of you who slept through that class in your public health program, it's what we do all the time. We first look for things that catch our gaze as matters of interest, and we follow them a little bit. We go through the sluggish and oftentimes year-long work of building relationships and identifying key informants. This is very hard to explain to funders, and this is where we spend all of our money, lunch. We then build working groups of folks in our community, and our community of interest is healthcare providers. We then ask those people what keeps them up at night, and we track those things to identify some projects. We then implement those projects with staff. We have 25 full-time staff members, and then we engage in co-evaluation with the community around the project. And then we repeat this over and over and over again. We have 14 active working groups. Examples of working groups include groups of dentists. We have a maternal child health group with maternal fetal medicine specialists and pediatricians, all working around emergency management issues. For most of them, they know nothing about emergency management, which is great. That's what we like. We want to hear what keeps them up as clinicians at night. So it was... It's not news that sexual assault and domestic violence issues around disaster has been a bigger deal in the last few years. And we scan and keep an eye on these sorts of things in the industry, and this caught our gaze. And so we sat around with our team and decided whether or not this was something that we were interested in. We let it simmer for a few months, and then eventually we decided that, yes, in fact, we think the issue of assault, particularly sexual assault, which I'll explain in a little bit, and intimate partner violence was something that we were interested in looking at. And it's really no reason why, as we were fairly convinced that this would lead to increased use of hospital services during an emergency. And since our job is to play defense for hospitals, we wanted to make sure that the sexual assault and domestic violence community was well prepared to continue their functions during an emergency. We like to say this is maybe not the right motive, but good work. And so, in my world, you can't have both all the time. So we figure this is pretty good. A quick note, by the way, about the research around sexual assault and domestic violence after disaster. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the literature. I would describe it as largely inconclusive. I think there is anecdotal evidence that violence increases, but I'm not sure that we've seen that really well studied or documented. One thing we do know is that service use increases, and that's oftentimes because people are displaced, et cetera. So from our perspective, it wasn't important that we knew sexual assault or domestic violence increased after an emergency, but only that service utilization increased, because that was really what we were focused on. We'll leave answering that first question to others. We built a working group, and I put the names here. I think what's most important is sort of the various sorts of folks that we got involved together. And these are people we were lucky enough who work together all the time. They sit in working groups on other organizations. And so we went to them and said, we don't want to reinvent the wheel. We'd like to buy you lunch. And so we asked them all to come out to our office. We bought them lunch. And we started asking them questions about what would happen in an emergency. And we had a couple of champions early on. Anita Carpenter at the Indiana Coalition Against Sexual Assault was a key one. And also Caroline Fisher at the Center for Hope, who's a sexual assault nurse examiner. And they were very much interested in working with us. We had no money. We told them we didn't need it. We were going to just self-fund this. So they liked that. We weren't asking any money for them. And one of the things that they first started asking, and by the way, we had lots of things that light up and are look cool at our office. So it's fun to have people come over and talk about different worlds. And Joanne's here, she knows. But you come to our office, and if you're used to working in a domestic violence shelter or a sexual, rape crisis center, you come to our office, and it's an emergency operations center, and there's lots of weird things around. It's a cultural exchange more than anything, and we love those the best, actually. So this group got together. We have an NPH that worked specifically on this project, Savannah Lean, and she assembled this group, and using everything she learned in school, she sat around and she said, what do you guys want to talk about? And there was, I think, about 20 minutes of uncomfortable silence until someone started talking, and the next thing you know, they started identifying projects. It took us about 3 meetings for them to identify the things that we saw as potential projects where we could make a difference. They came up with a lot of things that we didn't feel like we could help them with. So we kind of put those in a parking lot for later consideration. One was shelter and safety and congregate sheltering. I will tell you this is an issue we'd never even considered, which just goes to show why you need to partner with people who are experts in the field you're dealing with. It was the first thing out of their mouths, and I remember turning to Savannah and going, oh my gosh, I cannot believe that's an issue. And of course it's an issue. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a second. The other thing was continuity of their own operations, which we suspected may be a problem. Very few of these organizations had really thought through their own continuity plans if there was an emergency. Of course, we told them they already knew how to do this. Most of them were engaged in safety planning with individuals on a constant basis. They never really just turned that lens on an organization, which we helped them do. And finally was the availability of sexual assault nurse examiners and how that works in the city, which was a whole new area for us, which I'll explain in a second. I'll start by talking about congregate shelter safety. I don't know how many of you are involved in emergency planning in your communities. It varies widely, but generally speaking, in the United States, the Red Cross has primary responsibility for non-medical congregate sheltering in the United States. They are more into medical sheltering now, although I will tell you that's been with mixed results. partly because of policy and partly just because of the expertise of volunteers. It varies widely from community to community. We thought this was an interesting one, so we invited the Red Cross to come meet with these folks on our working group. It was the first time they'd interacted, not necessarily with someone from the Red Cross, but someone from Chris Gilbert, who works with our sheltering operations. And the conversation was interesting because the advocates and community members rightfully asked some tough questions, like, what's the plan to keep, you know, our community safe in this congregate environment? And the answer was, you know, we don't have a great plan. And they don't have no plan, but they don't have a great plan. And so we immediately then identified that's a place for further work. And I will tell you, that conversation is still ongoing. What it looks like to, for example, screen. Now, you'll appreciate this. For child protection, oh man, there, you name it, everything was ready. They could go to the sex offender list. They could do X and Y and Z. But for protection of other adults, there weren't a lot of systems in place. And this is actually a really challenge, especially where you don't have court orders in place or other things. There just aren't systems built for this. So I don't have a resolution here other than to tell you that this has started a dialogue, which has really lasted over the last year and a half, which we're continuing to work on. This is not a fix. There's no end to this. So it's not like one day the Red Cross is going to say, we fixed this, now you're going to be safe in a shelter. Some of it has to do with working police officials who are going to be working in the shelters to have them understand ways to keep people safe. It may be that people don't want to be removed from their abuser, right, for obvious reasons in the shelter. So it's not as simple as saying, well, we can take you to a different place. So it's much more nuanced, as you all know. The other was continuity of operations. We attacked continuity of operations by simply helping them do it. And we launched a series of workshops for all the sexual assault and domestic violence organizations in the city at no cost to them, where we took them through their entire continuity of operations plans. If something were to happen to a residential shelter, what they would do with the residents. If it was a non-residential shelter a non-residential program, what they would do to keep services going. We did that because, again, we want to make sure that the service providers who are experts are the ones providing services, and that healthcare providers who often, as you all know, we're not the best at this all the time, aren't trying to take those places. This is a screenshot from those sort of workshops. And these workshops, by the way, are 8-hour workshops. They're all day, and you leave with the plan. So very efficient, very effective. And we're about, I would say, 70% penetration on the sector, and our goal is 100%, so because we don't have a timeline. So we can keep doing it until we're done, and then we'll do it again, over and over and over again. And these things have to be revisited. I want to talk a little bit more about the SANEs. I, of course, I'm a nurse. I know what SANEs are. I know how important they are. They do extraordinary work. What I was not clear would happen out of this working group was sort of a new system would be developed. We track hospital capacity and diversion status in the city of Indianapolis and actually in several areas around Indiana. And we do that, and it's made immediately available to ambulance crews, et cetera, in the street. And we were just simply showing the working group this, I think, on the nickel tour we were giving them of our office, and one of the sexual assault nurse examiners raised her hand and says, so I know what we're going to do. You're going to add us to that system, and you're going to let police officers in their vehicles see when we're available. And we said, oh, yeah, that's easy. That's like 5 seconds of coding. And literally, before we left the office that day, we had created a system by which, in the city of Indianapolis, every police officer, every fireman, and every EMS official in the city of Indianapolis can see the status of every SANE in the city, whether they're in an exam, whether they're about to start an exam, et cetera. This was something that was so ridiculously easy for us to do. We did not know it was important. We did not understand how a big deal it was. But it got immediate buy-in from this working group to do the stuff we cared about. And this was just fortuitous luck. We would never have known this would have mattered if we hadn't invited them to dialogue. So I think this is one of the biggest wins of our entire project, even though from our perspective it doesn't really have anything to do with emergency management. It's a really good example of what being open and inviting community to dialogue can do. I will tell you, for them, they're now so reliant on it that IndyTrack has never gone down, but it was unavailable for about 30 seconds once. And I immediately got a phone call, my personal cell, and they said, is everything okay? And I'm like, we have a whole tech support team. So this is good. Then this is a nice project. And by the way, this is so easily duplicated in other communities, because a lot of your communities, especially if you're in big cities, if you don't have something exactly like this, is anybody from Washington State by chance? Well, you'd be a good candidate for this. You could move to Washington. I wanted to say kind of where we're going next here in closing so that I have time for the other speakers. But we believe that we are probably only touching the surface of opportunities for us to work together. One of the things that we're really interested in doing is training healthcare providers to be more agile and flexible and more MacGyver-like during disaster. So healthcare professionals have had the MacGyver sort of beaten out of us by safety protocol and et cetera, which is good. But we know that the difference that makes a difference in hospitals that do well in crisis and those that don't are very agile and nimble providers who can get creative. We train healthcare providers to do this in a number of ways by proxy. So we'll take them in wilderness medicine classes. We'll take them out to the woods, you know, teach them to do a tracheostomy with a steak knife, you know, or we'll teach them to use different splinting material if the roof falls down. Can you use part of the roof to splint arms and legs, things like that. One of our working group members said, you know, and ultimately, by the way, that all plays into resilience, right, which is, of course, the ultimate goal in an emergency management organization is to build resilience. And one of our working group members said, well, you know, if you're interested in resilience, you should come hang out with my clients because they're really resilient. And I said, oh, totally. That's interesting. What would that look like? And so one of the things we're developing now with this working group is to think about tech transfer, right? But low-tech transfer, which is how do we take resilient individuals who are really good at planning for crisis, who are really good at adapting to emergencies, who are really good at making massive changes very quickly and then rebounding, and we get them to help train providers to do the same. And that will be a really bizarre, weird thing that may or may not work, but we're giving it a shot. And again, what we know is that this is what emergency management looks like. It doesn't always look like vests and walkie-talkies and cars with sirens. We have all those things, but ultimately it comes down to building resilience in communities, and this is just an example of one way we started to do that in the sexual assault and domestic violence community. Thanks. Yeah.